when I was early in my career, I admired the people that had all of the answers. I admired the people that seemed like they had all of the subject matter expertise and did all of the talking in the room and had all the answers. Like, wow, like I can't wait until I can get to like that level of knowledge. And now I'm like over a decade into my career, and those people bug the shit out of me, dude. Welcome to the Workflow Podcast, a place where we'll navigate the professional landscape together, exploring how stuff really gets done in the working world. I'm Sam.
And I'm Derek.
And we're ready to uncover the tools you need to make a lasting impact, grow as a professional, grow as a human, and to build a career that you love. So with that, let's settle into the workflow.
Sam, what's up, man? I'll just start that again.
What's
Sam? Just shut the fuck up.
What's up, dude? How's it going?
Sam, what's up, man?
It's been a while. We definitely just started talking.
Yeah, we definitely just started talking. We haven't been talking over each other for the past 30 seconds. It's been a bit since we actually hit the record button. We had a couple lined up, and we both had some vacations lined up. So just getting back into it. How you doing?
Feels good, man. Yeah, good. Yeah, we're both back from our trips through the Caribbean and South America with a nice maple syrupy brown tan, ready to slam some podcasts.
A little bronzed. Yeah.
Yeah.
So today, I wanted to unpack a book that recently crossed both of our desks from a very, you know, workflow targeted perspective. But just to set the frame here, the book that we read is called Multipliers by Liz Wiseman, and it really approaches from a leader perspective. But the whole premise of the book is mapping out what makes a leader a quote-unquote multiplier versus a diminisher. Now, the definition that she gives for a multiplier versus a diminisher is a multiplier essentially amplifies the intelligence and capabilities of the people around them, essentially getting the most out of their team. Whereas a diminisher is a leader who drains the intelligence and energy from their teams, hindering their effectiveness and stifling the group. So if you think about a classic diminisher is somebody that landed in a leadership role without the official like human skill training and ends up relying on the same skills that got them into a high-performing individual contributor role, never detaching away from that and going into a manager role is like the classic definition that they give. There are a lot more nuances. And from a leadership perspective, the book talks about how to get the most out of your team. And they talk about, Liz talks about a multiplier equaling a genius maker. So if I ask you, what is a multiplier? The best simple example that I or definition I can come up with is instead of you feeling like you're the smartest person in the room or talking the most in a meeting, the people walk away with feeling like they're the smartest people in the room when they leave. So like a sense of energy and passion and a sense of inspiration that, hey, I can do this and I have everything I need. So that's to me, that's the core difference between a multiplier and a diminisher. I'd love to get like your perspective too, Sam, because this is a book that I started reading and I passed it off to you. And you seem to like it too. Anything to add in terms of the framing?
Yeah. The one thing that I'll add is that the fundamental insight I think the book brings is that most teams and people and their skills are completely underutilized. So geniuses in the agency of others, I think, is like a common phrase. So what we understand and like we know objectively is that people have a lot more capacity to do awesome work and to come up with really great creative ideas However, the challenge that has been identified in the book as well is that most traditional like leadership structures and ways of leading people actually diminishes that creative space and that capacity. And so there are like a set of very specific actions that most managers take either intentionally or unintentionally that actually stifle the output of a team. And the optimistic take on it is that like, if you act more like a multiplier, what you're actually doing is you're getting a lot more out of less people. And you're creating a space where like those people can actually flourish and do great work. And the framework that she offers in the book is basically a set of really actionable tactics and a bunch of gotchas that folks can potentially do to either become more of a multiplier or less of a diminisher.
Yeah, I think the classic, and that's really good framing. She brings up the traditional way of growing a team as well. And you kind of touched on it, which is the linear way of, you know, land grabbing, saying like, I have a team of five. Hey, I have to make the justification to grow my team because I want to like grow the people underneath me, and I will add people to the team. So like, let's add three headcount. But she says, as a leader, let's make sure that the five that you have, you're getting as close to 100% before taking that step. And I think that whole linear hiring model is where most companies are. So it's really powerful stuff.
Yeah, it's like a default way of thinking.
It's totally default. And I think it's a natural trap that people fall into. For our podcast, there's a lot that we can unpack with this book, but not everybody listening to this call is a manager or in an official leadership capacity. So what I thought would be cool is to unpack a specific part of the book where everybody has diminishing qualities in terms of leadership. And the people listening to this podcast probably have managers that either have one or more of these characteristics of what makes a diminishing leader a diminisher. But the vast majority of leaders out there are not intentionally diminishing their team. It's mostly blind spots, right? So the definition that Liz comes up with in the book is the accidental diminisher, right? So it's these archetypes that she forms around them. And there are seven archetypes that we'll go through one by one, that there are specific behaviors that the leader means well, and they can be looked at as strengths, but they could have the other effect and swing too far to the other end and diminish the team. And for the people listening, not necessarily being from the perspective of a manager and where to show her up, but from the bottom up, how can I bring that up to my manager in a way that's going to be effective?
Okay, so there's that for sure. There's, I want to understand these archetypes of diminishing qualities so that I can help provide feedback, like an upward management to, you know, the person that's running the team. The other thing as well is, and I feel like I'm a broken record in saying this on this podcast, is that like leadership occurs at every single level. You can be a leader the first year of your career. You can act like a leader. And I would even go as farther to say, like, you should try to act like a leader, like on day one. And that, like, leadership qualities aren't necessarily gated by the fact that you have a team or not. And so each of these diminishing qualities, I've seen those embodied, and I've certainly embodied them myself, like from ICs, like people that are just, they don't have a team, but they still could act this way. And it still kind of diminishes like other folks around them if they're on their team or not. And so they're just helpful things to watch out for just as you operate in a company. Doesn't matter which level you're in.
Totally. Great point. So let's just get right into it. So of the seven, first one is the idea guy. And my hand's up right now because this one out of all of them resonated with me the most, because I've done this and I still do this. The idea guy is brimming with ideas, you know, overflowing with creativity, always has a constant stream of suggestions. And the diminishing effect that could have is that the people that are around you or underneath you can lose sight of what's really mattering and what matters the most. What are the priorities? So I've been in a situation where I've been in a meeting and where it's like a brainstorming session, and we come out of the meeting with like 15 different things. And then all of a sudden, like, every person has their own little passion project, and the core things that we needed to get done don't get done. Right. Or there's delay and we have to refocus. So I definitely felt like I resonated with the idea guy archetyped.
Yeah. If you're the person that's always bringing like a million ideas into the conversation because you're excited and you're energetic about it, et cetera, you may be just taking up a lot of air in the room as well. And other folks may not think that like their idea is as worthy, because like you're full of 20 ideas, they only have one. Maybe they're going to stay silent. So that's kind of the unintentional kind of diminishing that could happen with the best intentions. Because the flip side of that equation is that as the idea guy, like, I want to catalyze a conversation, you know? I'm super energetic about like this thing, and I want to come to this meeting, and I want to throw out all these ideas and have a dynamic brainstorm. That's like a pretty honest and seemingly harmless thing, right? I do the same thing all the time, and I'm just generally like an energetic person. So I'm sure that I've like crowded out other ideas by spewing my own as well.
The second one is the always on archetyped. So I think you just kind of transition nicely from the last one into this one. Some of these overlap, but it's a leader that is so energetic and present that they can dominate the team space. So you're talking about taking up space in the room. This leader, I think, more than the idea guy, can do that by, and let me be very clear. This is not a guy or girl thing. I just have this terminology of saying, hey, the idea guy or the always on guy, but this is an archetype that has no gender attached to it. it can make the always on person can leave the team feeling like they cannot get in word and edgewise and contribute to their own ideas. Right. So in the book, it talked about a potential solution or action is don't oversell your idea or your opinion. Say it one time and then let the conversation unfold around you and give people space, give the team space to then give their own opinions, right? Because a lot of the times, and this is going to be a common theme throughout all of these archetypes, is the right intention is there. What do you want to get out of it, right? You want to get a collaborative, synergized end result where you feel like there's a space where everybody can have their voice known. So if you're always on, you're just soaking up all the oxygen in the room.
This is a cool one. One of my favorite ones, because when I'm thinking about like the arc of my career and like who I admired when I was early in my career, I admired the people that had all of the answers. I admired the people that seemed like they had all of the subject matter expertise and did all the talking in the room and had all the answers. Like, wow, like I can't wait until I can get to like that level of knowledge. And now I'm like over a decade into my career, and those people bug the shit out of me, dude. And I can be that person sometimes too. So like I will say it. It's hard not to be, especially when you do acquire all of the subject matter expertise and you need to kind of check your ego. But now I admire the person that is silent for most of the conversation, that sits back, lets the conversation unfold, and then comes in with just a very well articulated question that gets to the core of the issue, or a really well articulated thought or piece of feedback that's based on all of the ideas that have been presented. And it takes the conversation in a more positive way. That is really like what you should be aspiring to. Not the person that is like dominating the conversation, talking 80% of the time, and in some strange ego-driven way thinking like, oh, you're going to bring along all of these people with you as you're doing all of this talking. Because that rarely actually is the case. It's much cooler to be that like silent assassin in the room that is like conjuring on like a good point. And so that's really the I guess the converse or the opposite of this always on archetype, right?
Number three, the rescuer. And this is an interesting one because a lot of leadership books will kind of lead you down this road, but it's the spawned out of good intention, wanting to prevent their team from failing. They'll jump in and too quickly try to solve the problem for them because they don't want to, you know, it hurts them to see their team struggling. So they want to jump in and help. Again, good intentions, but it's depriving the team members from having the opportunity to learn and find solutions on their own. So again, you know, this is a common theme. The probably the question that people have is, hey, which archetype are you? I've been all of them. I've jumped in too quickly and tried to help somebody that was struggling either in a presentation, right? I've been in that situation where somebody was giving a presentation on my team and it was just going terribly. And it's like, every atom in my body is just cringing and they want to step in and help. I've been that person. I've helped out my team with a situation where they could have collaborated with the business better. I've done it from a lot of different angles. So this one resonated with me as well.
This one's tough for me. I struggle to see how actionable this one is, because like where do you draw the line? Simon Sinek has like a lot of thinking about like leadership on this front too, and what he talks about is being effectively like leadership being the protector, right? In the social circle, the leaders in the group protect folks from threats that are coming in from the outside, and in exchange for that, you know, they're compensated as such and they have like a higher status in the group. And so to some degree, like, as a manager or a leader, you should be absorbing a lot of the problems and a lot of the threats and a lot of the challenges. But there's like a balance there because you also need to expose those challenges and those threats to your team so that they can develop and deal with them. And, you know, we had that episode on messing up and failing. Mm-hmm. And how reframing failing to be a good thing. You also, as a leader, need to let your team fail sometimes. And so, like, where is that fucking line? Like, it's really hard. I don't know. I can't remember. Did she talk about that specifically? Like, where that line is?
So the scenario that she gave is when someone brings you a problem. Right. Hey, boss, I'm struggling with finding the answer to this, or this person's being really difficult. I think what a lot of leaders do is they jump in and give their opinion on how to solve for that. The suggestion that she gives is ask the questions first. Try to dig deep into what the team member is thinking or has already done. So, for example, instead of coming up with a solution, ask, how do you think we can solve it? What do you think you should do? And because we've always had those leaders that, at least from my perspective, the best leaders that I can remember are the ones that they might have had the answer already, but they make it seem like it's your idea.
Mm. That's cool.
So asking questions in a way that can lead them, like leading the horse to water and letting them drink, or teaching a person to fish. Instead of giving them a fish, whatever that expression is, you get what I'm saying? Make the person arrive at the answer rather than giving it to them right away, because they might just, like a robot, take that advice and verbatim move it over. But if it's their idea, that'll imprint and that'll scale into the future and, you know, help them learn.
Yeah, that's a cool one. I have like kind of a practical example of this one. I had one of my reports, he was like running a large cross-functional sync. And over time, just as large cross-functional syncs do, it started to get really not productive. Like, people were messaging on the side and like not, there wasn't great engagement. And, you know, like most people had their videos off and they're muted. You just knew, or I just knew that it was a meeting that did not need to happen, but we were doing it every week. And so instead of telling this person to cancel the meeting, in our next one-on-one, I just asked him how he thought it was going. And he ultimately got to like, yeah, we should probably just cancel this and do it asynchronously, which was cool. So like, that's maybe a like actual practical example of how to not be a rescuer in that scenario.
Number four, the pace setter. So this one, I think you might have some opinions on, because I think this one is a hard one to define as well. But the archetype defined in the book is the person that is working at breakneck speed, setting high standards, and accomplishing so much that it inevitably leaves such a gap between that person's achievements versus the rest of the team that the team might be discouraged, you know, demotivated, and realize like, hey, or lead to burnout and do too many things to try to catch up. So that's the definition of the book. I want to hear your perspective on this one.
Just based on that definition, I disagree. I think that leaders should set a high standard for work. And we live in a employment at will kind of country, which is absolutely amazing. You join a fast-paced environment. Every freaking resume says like, hey, do you want to join a fast-paced environment? And this sometimes is what fast-paced environments are. You have to work a little extra. You have to work hard. And when you have leaders, either peers or, you know, team leaders that are busting their ass and they're in the trenches with you, to me, that's like a net good thing. And you can balance that with all the other things that can be done to mitigate burnout. Like we discussed burnout on the last episode, creating the space for talking about that kind of stuff, being clued into your team, building those relationships. But yeah, dude, I think like being a pace setter is a net good thing.
I agree. I think that if you're sharing it all the time, for one, that might be annoying, right? Like, hey, look at me sort of situation. But if you're just, you know, going out there and getting results and doing your job and you're just really good at it, there's this whole thing around, you know, high performing people don't want to work with low performing people. And if you tolerate low performers, then the high performers are going to be disgruntled and either leave or they're going to sink down to the low level performer. Right. So yeah. If you're leading by example and you have high performers around you, you're going to really like add credibility to them by going above and beyond. I just think it all comes around like how you're doing it. If you're out there and you're you know, you're crushing it and you're going above and beyond like you should be, just keep your ego in check and don't do it for the reasons of getting, you know, making the team realize like how good you are. I think that's where it could diminish.
Yeah. I mean, I would also make the argument that if you're kicking ass, like you should be sharing all of your ass kicking. And I agree. Like there is some how there. Shreyas Doshi, the Twitter guy, the product marketing or product management Twitter guy, he has some awesome like writing and thinking on this. He makes a delineation between optics-driven people and impact-driven people. And you can get pretty freaking far in a company being an optics-driven person. You write beautiful newsletters every month about all the great stuff you've done. Your PowerPoints are polished, et cetera, et cetera. Like, you present really well. You build really great relationships. But underneath all of that, you don't like impact a lot of stuff. You don't like ship a bunch of meaningful stuff. That's less productive, right? To be like skew too far on like the optics driven persona. And then the impact persona is like the opposite of that, right? You're laser focused on the set of projects and priorities that are going to move the company forward, and you work on those and you get shit done. Now in reality, like a healthy balance of both is probably the optimal mix. You don't want to just be purely impact and not share any of that stuff, because no one's ever going to know that you're doing it. or it'll be a lot harder for people to know that you're doing it.
This one's tough. This one's tough because, yeah. I mean, I think from a, you know, now we're getting into like leadership principles, right? I think that if you're sharing, you're not going to be the only person as a part of that initiative that you just made impact on. So like from my perspective, I've been a part of and I've led really, you know, impactful initiatives, but I feel very uncomfortable being in a situation where I share, hey, look what I've done. Where I feel more comfortable is raising up the people or that we're helping make that a reality and making it more about them rather than about me. So I think that's that's where the balance can kind of, you know, you can have that balance is you can be like really a key player in these initiatives. But when you share it, it should be about the people that helped and the infrastructure that helped you get there rather than about, look what I've done and what I impacted as a part of that. Now, if you're in an interview, it's a completely different story. Sell the shit out of it, right?
Yeah.
But for the optics of the team, you don't want to diminish others as well by making it about you when you they knew that they were a big part of it. You want to make sure that they got most of the credit rather than yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And like recognizing that, and another way to do that too is like not just zoning in on your personal accomplishments as a leader, but zoning in on like, you know, really impact driven folks around you on the team and raising them up and being like, making an example of someone that did great work. Like even if that is like, even if they did work at a breakneck speed and you want to set that high standard with this example of this person on your team, you're elevating that person and you're setting an example, intentionally that like, this is like the standard of work that I want happening on my team, because it's great and it's high quality and there's operational excellence, et cetera. And so I'm going to recognize that like, if there's burnout and, you know, discouraging folks like on the edges of that, I think that can be managed in other ways.
That's a cost. Yeah. That's a cost of doing business, right? In some way. I think that also if like you're demotivated because of somebody else's achievements, or you're feeling burned out because you're trying to reach that and you can't, and you're upset about it, I think that we got to look in the mirror and take some accountability as well. Like, the whole intrinsic motivation versus extrinsic. I lean very heavily into the intrinsic. So yeah, this one was tough. So the next one, number five, the rapid responder. I've also done this, and I think this is a really cut and dry one. I don't have a lot of pushback on this archetype, but the rapid responder is a leader who's quick to react and solve problems. And can inadvertently create an environment where the team feels their contributions are necessary or overlooked. So the scenario that I'm thinking about is I get an email from a disgruntled stakeholder saying, this thing's not working in production, help, SOS, maybe with a little urgent outlook indicator to make maintenance priority. I've been in situations where I've jumped in and I've responded. But that's not my main primary responsibility. I should have given some SLA time in between the sender, me receiving it, versus when I expected the team to get on it. Because I ended up, one, adding more things to my plate, and two, making the team potentially feel like they have less responsibility or ownership over that primary duty.
Would a better way to do that just be like when you got that urgent message, hit up the person that like should be responding to it and be like, hey, can you do this?
Here's where I thought about that. Here's where it could go off the rails. And this is, I've been on the receiving end of this where I got the email, I was typing up my response, or maybe it was super early in the morning or late at night and I haven't had the opportunity to reply, but I've seen it. Yeah. Where if I get that notification from my boss saying, hey, is this on your radar? I feel annoyed. And like, also, I don't feel as motivated to respond and own it all the way through, because now, like, hey, you're nagging me about it. That's probably an immature way or a reaction, but I know probably others do as well. So like, that's where it becomes a fine line. Like, how long do you give of a window of time before you reach out to your employee, and how long of a window do you give before you actually just take it on yourself and respond to that.
Makes sense.
Number six, the optimist. The unwavering belief that everything will work out, you know, hey, I believe in my team. You guys got this. And then go away. Don't worry. I know that you guys got this. You guys are smart. You guys are the smartest team I've ever been a part of. You got this. You remember that last thing that you handled? You can do this one too. So the challenge or the consequence of this is, unless you also share the challenges and you're transparent and you're upfront about how hard this will actually be, team, you are potentially diminishing your team by not acknowledging the winding road and all of the blockers and challenges that the team will face to make something a reality.
Yeah, I like this one a lot. I've never defaulted to this, but I actually see this a lot more with like senior leadership. Like we're in crypto, and it's like a really tough industry. You know, like a lot of days it feels like the entire government is out to get you, and a lot of times, like, you know, senior leadership would like get up on an all hands and be like, the tides are like going in our favor, everything's good, like we're killing it. But then like you go back to your day job and like just problems and problems and bombs going off everywhere, and you don't feel seen. That is like a massive challenge. The converse of that is like when you have a leader that, you know, gets up there, and this happens as well, increasingly so more now, where they get up there and they're like, look, we are in a tough, tough space. It feels like Armageddon sometimes. And me as a human, like a leader, like I feel that. I get tired. I get stressed out. And so leveling with your team, with your crew, on the fact that like it's not all, you know, roses and poppy seeds all the time. Poppy seeds. It's definitely not poppy seeds, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, you can make some good stuff with that.
Roses and poppy seeds. It makes you it makes you feel seen, and like it, you know, it makes you feel like that that leader is like in the trenches with you, which I think is like a very, very important thing for like a team dynamic.
And last but not least, the protector. I think this is the archetype that you were describing more on the rescuer side. But yeah, the protector is the shit shield, you know, deflecting all of the BS and external pressures and challenges, you know, because that's what servant leadership really talks about, right? It's like, how can I work for you, and how can I shield you from all of the adversity out there so that you can focus on your job? I think there's a lot of goodness that can come out of that. However, I do feel like if instead you give your team a little bit of transparency into the struggles that you've kind of deflected, or into a little bit of the harsh realities that are out there, there could be like real learning opportunities in there that by picking and choosing which ones to share can help the team from a growth perspective. And also give them a sense of like managing down in terms of what are the things that you're doing for them. Because if you shield everything and they don't know that you're shielding it, they might not give you any credit at all. And like, you've really been going to bat for them. So I think there's a little bit of a windshield there where some of the stuff should go through them.
Where does the like rubber hit the road on this one?
When you say rubber meet the road, what do you mean?
Yeah, like what's an example of like when this happens, you know? Because like I think about like external pressures and challenges. Something that we went through last year was like a massive reorg. And like I needed to like work through like the implications on my team for the reorg before like sharing it with them. I think that that's like not something I would share with my team, you know, ahead. Like, because reorgs are challenging, they're external. You don't need to know about it until like we have more of a plan there, because there's nothing you can do to control it. And maybe it's like, maybe it's external pressures or challenges that like they can actually impact and do something about. But yeah, I again, like with some of these, I just like, I struggle to draw the line.
So the way I look at this is, let's say, for example, from above you, you're getting asked to change the way you're working, in terms of going with a process that another team has adopted, but for the sake of consistency, you're now being asked to adhere to their process. A true shielding is to deal with all of the challenges and all the strife outside of your team, and then to just come up with an answer and then, you know, cascade that down. Where I've kind of gone the other way is, as soon as I understand that there's something that's coming down the pike that's going to impact them, seek their feedback and say, like, here's what I'm getting from above me or across from me that I might not have a lot of ability to influence, but what do you think about if we change our process from A to B for the sake of consistency? Where would our biggest challenges be? What would your initial reaction be? And more, it's like one-on-ones and stuff like that. I think in a public forum, it could get a little bit of like a mutiny sort of thing. But if you do it very tactfully and you say, here's the pressure that I'm getting, what are your initial thoughts on it? So that way you can start to, one, give them a sense of what you're coming across, but two, get them bought into it so that maybe you can actually surface some of their opinions before the decision has already left the stable to, you know.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So there's some things you can't share, right? Like the org change stuff, you can't share. If you're you've got an impending layoff coming, you can't share that, right? So like,
yeah. Yeah, you know? I got to decide who I'm letting go on this team, guys. I want to work through this together.
Who do you think who's the lowest performer? Who should we kill? Who should we?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's, I like the framework because there's themes on these, and I think when you pull out the themes, they're not contradictory. You should collaborate with your team well. You should give your team agency. You should let them work on problems and figure that stuff out. You shouldn't hoard work. You should let your team develop. Like, these things, when I just say them like that, every manager ever is like, yeah, I definitely do that with my team. I ensure that I do that with my team. But we just went through like a bunch of examples of a manager or a leader or somebody with the best intentions doing the exact opposite of that. And that's why I think the framework is useful, is it kind of creates that like reframing. Because a lot of these are like knee-jerk reactions. Oh my gosh, a pissed off customer reached out to one of my reports and they haven't responded yet. It's been an hour. I got this. I'm going to handle it, right? That's like a knee-jerk reaction. That's actually like handicapping your team or somebody that you work with.
So we went through all of the archetypes. We kind of approached it from a leadership perspective. Now, flipping on the other side of this equation, where you have a individual who is not a manager, but they're experiencing people around them, maybe their manager right above them or manager on another team, that is a classic one or more archetypes that we've just went through. Do you have any tips, tricks, frameworks for how they can bring that feedback forth without diminishing the manager themselves?
Yeah, I think the FBI framework here, the Simon Sinek, like FBI framework is really good.
I'm going to be the rapid responder right now. It's the feeling, behavior, then impact. So
exactly.
FBI like is, hey, I'm feeling this way because of this behavior, and the impact that it's having or has the potential to have is XYZ. So
right.
I'm feeling frustrated because you responded to an email within a half an hour of receiving it when I was actually drafting up my own response, and it's my primary responsibility. And I feel like the impact of that is you're setting the wrong precedence with the customer, and then, you know, you're diminishing my role a little bit because you're stepping in front of the customer.
Exactly. Yeah. Same thing with the rescuer or the rescuer framework, like jumping in to solve big problems. Like, hey, I'm feeling a little slighted because there was this complex problem that came up. that, you know, we as the team like have the capacity to handle, but you jumped on it and worked on it, and we know you've done that like before. However, like the impact there is like we want to develop, we want to learn, and this was like a perfect opportunity for us to do that, like with your guidance. Maybe next time this comes up, can we handle it first with, you know, close partnership from you?
Beautiful. And imagine getting that feedback that's thoughtful in that way from your people. I mean, it might sting a little bit, but if you're like a good manager, there's truth in anything that is a little bit provoking, right? So I think the majority of managers would want to know where their blind spots are, because this sort of behaviors and these diminishing qualities more often than not go under the radar and are never brought up, right? Like,
yeah.
So
exactly,
you're a true value. You're going to be considered, you know, the close circle of people that if they want real candid feedback, you'll get more of those opportunities to from your manager as well. Could open up some doors.
Yeah. There's some harder ones on here though, like the idea guy or the always on person. It's really hard for someone who like takes up all the air in the room. Are you really going to go to that person and be like, "Hey, you talked way too much during that meeting." Like that's probably like a much harder conversation to have.
But like use an FBI for that. Yeah, like try give it a shot for like somebody. Let's set the stage. You just left a brainstorming session with your boss where, you know, for the hour that you were together, they talked for 45 minutes of it.
Yeah. Right. Hey, like I just want to let you know that me and some of the other team were chatting after that meeting. And some folks were feeling like they were a little squashed or crowded out, myself included, because you brought a lot of like energy in talking to that meeting, but not a lot of other people had like something to say there. And I know for a fact that Bob or Alice have some ideas like in this space, and they didn't get to share them on that forum. And it may be useful to get like all the ideas out on the table so we can analyze them and figure out the best one. Maybe next time, like we can make sure that we, you know, give the space for everybody to speak, or we try to create some kind of like pre-read that gives everybody the chance to like throw down their ideas, something like that. Still a challenging conversation to have from my perspective. I think that's like a lot harder, but like doable, you know, if you're brave. Another way to do it would be like in the moment, you can try to like massage the conversation in such a way that gives other folks the opportunity to speak. And this is an opportunity for leadership at any level for sure. If there is like one person in the room that's taking up all the air and talking, and you know for a fact that like somebody else is like trying to say something, there's nothing wrong with you being like, "Hey Alice, like I see you're trying to say something. Do you want to like jump in here? I know you had some thoughts on this." Like I love when people do that in conversations, especially mm-hmm. when they bring up somebody that's like obviously quiet or obviously shy, understands the subject matter. Their eyes are lighting up, or they want to butt in, but they just feel like they can't. Maybe they're raising their hand or something like that. This is definitely a signal of true leadership. Do you notice that? Do you notice that in the room? And do you give them space, create the space? As an observer of that, there's somebody that's taking up all of the air, and then there's somebody that butts in, and maybe they even cut that person off to give the space for somebody else to speak. I respect that move a lot.
Yeah. Raising of the hand is one. Another is people that use the side chat as a way of like talking. Like,
I don't like that.
Bringing
dude.
That up. Like, hey, Alice had this one thought. I thought it was really interesting. Alice, do you want to like elaborate on that?
Right.
But like, yeah, people use the side chat as if like that's their way of getting their opinion out there. If it's somebody's taking up all the room, maybe that's what's called for. I thought that what you just said was really interesting. Find opportunities for your team to create space, or the people around you to create space for them. I love that.
Yeah.
Put that on a t-shirt. I think one thing, like as a precursor to the FBI, if you're walking into a very hard conversation, then maybe start with some questions to your leader. Like for example, the idea brainstorming, start with, "Hey boss, how do you think that went?"
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was great, but I wish the team spoke up more. Boom. Opportunity.
Cool, man. This is a good one.
I really, really loved it.
Awesome, awesome. That's the pod. Hey, thanks for hanging out with us at The Workflow. If you like what you just heard, could you take 1 second and give us a like, subscribe, follow, or leave a review on the platform you're listening to this podcast? It will really help us out as we're growing the pod. We'd also love to hear from you. If you have ideas for future topics you'd like us to cover, folks you'd want us to chat with, or any feedback in general, just shoot us a note at workflowshow@gmail.com. Again, that's workflowshow@gmail.com. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.